This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview death penalty attorney David Michaels.
David will describe an historic development, the main legal institution that set forth the framework for killing people. The American Law Institute has withdrawn that framework, saying essentially, there's no way they can figure out in the current atmosphere to impose the death penalty in any fair way.
We speak with attorney Jim Lafferty as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series.
This is part two of our interview, and you'll hear Jim's perspectives on how we can build the anti-war movement and how we can begin to turn this country around.
Stay with us. This is Heidi Boghossian from Law and Disorder. I'm standing outside the Harlem office building at an emergency rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal. This, a day after the Supreme Court decided that it would remand or turn back the case to the Third Circuit. Listeners may remember that in 2008, the Third Circuit considered Mumia's case and favorably decided that there had been a constitutional violation in what we call the Mills claim. That had to do with the form that was given to the jurors when they were considering whether to impose a sentence of death or life in prison. There was a lot of confusion about that form and also about the instructions that Judge Albert Szabo gave to the jurors. This issue really goes to the heart of fairness in the entire death sentencing scheme around the country. And it was a particularly hopeful ray for Mumia because we thought he would prevail on this claim. What happened recently is that the Supreme Court delayed ruling on Mumia's case until it heard another somewhat similar Supreme Court case that involved a sentencing form also. They have ruled in a way that is not useful, we think, to Mumia's case. And while it could have been worse, they could have decided that he was not entitled to a new sentencing trial, as the Third Circuit had hoped he would get. It now goes back for reconsideration in light of this new so-called Spisak decision. We'll go into more detail in the studio about this, but I think the bottom line is that there's a resurgence of activism around Mumia's case right now because, although it may be several months before the Third Circuit hears it, it's really important that we continue to educate people about the many constitutional infractions in his case. As we'll hear later in the show, there's been a monumental change recently in the intellectual underpinnings of the capital justice system in this country.
In late 2009, the American Law Institute, which created the intellectual and legal structure for the current death penalty system in the United States, announced that its project had failed. They are no longer taking a position about the death penalty or saying that it can be legally imposed. The American Law Institute, or ALI, which is probably not familiar to many of you, is the most important legal institution in the United States. It is made up of around 4,000 judges, lawyers, and law professors that are involved in streamlining the law and setting up model codes that provide coherence in a federal legal system that has 50 states, a federal government, state, and local governments as well. In a 1962 model code, the best legal minds of the Institute framed a way for the death penalty to be carried out in what it considered, or what they considered, a fair way. They reinstated their position in 1976. Now the same people who set up that structure for, quote, fairness in the death penalty have said there is no fair system of capital punishment. The New York Times, in one article, said, quote, the Institute's move represents a tectonic shift in legal theory. The article also points out that capital punishment was plagued by problems, including racial disparities. Joining us to discuss this major development in the legal world of the death penalty is David Seth Michaels. David has represented death penalty clients for 30 years, including prison inmates in Mississippi and Tennessee. He worked with Brooklyn Legal Services B and with the Federal Defender's Service on appeals. He is also a novelist and has his own practice in New York.
Welcome, David, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just a few weeks ago, I believe, the American Law Institute has announced that its project, creating a structure, a sort of an intellectual structure for the current capital justice system, has failed. It's been nearly 50 years, so this is quite a turnabout. Can you explain how this happened and what your thoughts are on it?
Sure. I think that the place to begin was that the current capital punishment structure was created by ALI about half a century ago, almost half a century ago.
Tell us what ALI is, David.
The American Law Institute. It's a group that has about 4,000 members, judges, lawyers, law professors. It's really the intellectual group that tries to cobble together federal law in the United States. It does things like write restatements of law, it does analysis, it does reports. It's the brain trust, so to speak, in back of a lot of the federal law, and it certainly was the brain trust in back of capital punishment. It's the intellectual leaders of the law, so to speak, and the capital punishment rules that they invented 50 years ago have basically been the groundwork on which everything has happened since. So it comes as a bit of a shock that 50 years later they would say, uh-oh, it doesn't work, it won't work, we can't make it work, so what we're going to do is we're going to fold up our tents and we're disappearing, we're gone, we're not working on this anymore, we won't have anything else to do with it. And they issued a statement which says, I want to read it to you because it's an unbelievable statement. It says, quote, in light of the current intractable institutional and structural obstacles to ensuring a minimally adequate system for administering capital punishment, we disavow our structure.
What do you attribute their decamping to?
I think it's pretty clear from their statement that there were four things that almost everybody who's observed this area has been deeply troubled by, and they're deeply troubled by it too. And those things are that it's obvious that racial disparity has played a tremendous role in who gets executed and who doesn't. There's tremendous disparity that's regional across the United States about who gets executed and who doesn't. The prospect of having a capital punishment is ridiculously expensive. And it's ridiculously expensive, even though defense lawyers have been traditionally underpaid and many of them are incompetent in these cases. There's been an incredible risk of executing innocent people, and we've seen that because we've had about 140 death row exonerations since the restoration of capital punishment in the late 70s. And there's also issues undermining the process that are the result of politics that come from electing judges who suggest that people who violate the law should be wantonly executed. So there are all of these things that are unworkable in the system, and ALI woke up and said, oh my God, look at this thing we've created. We can't endorse it anymore.
David, I'm curious, you say ALI woke up, but surely there must have been grumblings over the last decade. All of the things you've cited, the 4 points, are not new.
No, they're not new at all.
Was there discussion within the organization to come out with this statement earlier?
Oh, yeah. This statement is a compromise because there was a faction of the ALI that wanted ALI to take a position and has been hammering away at it for quite some time that they should take a position saying, we oppose capital punishment. We're not going to endorse it in any circumstances. That didn't have enough votes, evidently, and so people settled for the current position, which is we're just not going to work on it anymore. We're done with it. What we did was wrong. We're finished.
It does leave an opening of some sort, right? But although everybody who's attempted to come up with a scheme, Illinois, other places, has been unable to. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's one of these circumstances where something is irreparably falling apart. It's irreparably broken. I think those of us who've been observing it for a while realized this a long, long time ago. But for a lot of reasons, people clung to hope that they could fix it, they could make it just, they could make it fair, they could make it a just and fair capital punishment system. And I think that what's finally happened is that over time, the underpinnings for this have fallen apart. Every place you turn, you find horrendous errors, you find egregious discrimination. And eventually, that takes a toll. It takes a long time to wear this kind of thing down where people say, that's it. I don't know how to fix it. Nobody knows how to fix it. And believe me, if the AOI doesn't know how to fix it, nobody knows how to fix it, because these people are viewed as being the intellectual leaders of this kind of legal theoretical stuff.
We're talking with Attorney David Michaels, death penalty attorney for many years, about the big turnaround, the American Law Institute's giving up. It's trying to fix the mechanism of the death penalty. Just walked away from their whole project. David, what disturbs me is the clear statistical findings that the death penalty is not a deterrent to the crime of murder. What was the rationale of people who wanted to use the death penalty in the face of that fact?
It's an amazing thing that there are no studies that show that it's an effective deterrent. In fact, what the studies seem to show is that the murder rate, the capital murder rate, is higher in places that have the death penalty than in places that don't have the death penalty. But there's been this continual arguing and the continually putting forward of scientific, in quotes, work that appears to show that there's a deterrent. So we've been spending a great deal of time in the last decade anyway debunking reports that claim that there's a deterrent effect when in fact there's none. So there's been all of this fight about that, in which people who are driven by their political desire to have capital punishment manage to fabricate reports that suggest that there might be deterrent. And then the opposition finds itself trying to go through the reports and finding that, in fact, the methodology isn't right and it's all nonsense. So it's been going on and on. There's absolutely no proof of deterrence whatsoever, and the statistics seem to say that when you do have a capital punishment statute, your murder rate's going to be higher.
Right. I've read that. I also read, David, that if the public at large actually knew the truth about, for example, the flaws in the system, the way, you know, jurors don't understand the instructions on aggregating and mitigating circumstances, if the public knew really the deep problems about the death penalty, there might be a shift in terms of public opinion. But in fact, the issue of that it's not a deterrent and other things like that aren't really widely known.
No, actually, I think that's exactly right, what you're saying. What I understand is that support for the death penalty, at least as far as polling is concerned, has been slowly and gradually decreasing, but it's still more than 50%. So what happens is that there's this basically denial in our society, which is like, that even though there have been 140 some odd, I think that's around the number, 140 exonerations from death row of people who were in face of being executed, even though they're not guilty, well, we just overlook that because that just shows that the appeal system is working, that we found 140. This is this kind of denial about this that continues, and the statistics don't ever make it through, primarily because I don't think you see them reported. And whenever there is an exoneration, people immediately argue that that's evidence that the system is working. I don't know how a system can work in which there are 140 exonerations. God knows how many people it is that we've executed who are actually innocent at this point.
Meanwhile, we have a body of decisions with the recent Spisak decision from the Supreme Court that actually seem to disregard the Mills decision, for example, on jury instructions. So it seems that it's getting more difficult for death row inmates to have any rights left.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think it's clear that in the Supreme Court, there are at least 4 and potentially 5 votes that don't think that there's anything the matter here and are prepared to uphold death penalties that are imposed virtually no matter what. And you have Justice Scalia saying recently, if somebody who is innocent is in fact ready to be executed, he doesn't have a major problem with that. That's not a constitutional problem.
Scalia actually said that the death penalty was sanctioned by God.
God hadn't told me that.
David, let me switch the inquiry here for a second and ask you, if I might, a personal question. How did you get involved in litigating these death penalty cases? And, you know, what is it that caused you to spend so many years of your life in what is just really anguishing work?
I originally got into this because in the early 70s, I was concerned about conditions in prisons, specifically in Tennessee and in Mississippi, and I was doing litigation about prisons and mental hospitals. And when I was doing this, I got to see what was going on in connection with people who were being convicted of capital crimes after the restoration in 1976 of the death penalty in this country. For one reason or another, I guess it's like a moth to a flame. There was something about that I found so egregious and so upsetting that I said, all right, I'll try to do what I can to get involved and stop it. So I began to do some work with other people and supporting other people. At the time, I was living in Mississippi. And I was in Mississippi until the late 70s when I returned to New York. And while I was in Mississippi, I was involved in lawsuits about institutions. It became clear to me two things, that conditions in institutions were horrible and that it was easier to keep people from getting sent to prison or to a mental institution than it was ever to get them out. One thing leads to another. I decided in the early 80s, I decided that I could take on a pro bono death penalty case in Mississippi, which I did. It was on direct appeal and discovered to my shock and horror that the lawyers who represented this person who I was appointed on appeal to represent had about 2 years of experience together. None of them had ever done a criminal trial. The case was tried by the guy who was then the district attorney in Gulfport, Mississippi. There was no mitigation evidence that was presented, and as far as I was concerned, they didn't even prove that there had been a murder committed by the person who they had charged. So I took the case on appeal. Fortunately, the Mississippi Supreme Court reversed the conviction and ordered a new trial. But the part that was bizarre about it was that one of the judges issued a dissenting opinion who said that the state law error that I had raised, which led to the reversal of the conviction, was something that was a bad rule, and that he was all for changing the rule on the spot so that this guy could be executed. That was a complete mind blow. It was astonishing to me. I never heard of such a thing. It's not even intellectually respectable point of view, but there's a guy who's saying, okay, kill my client, forget about the fact that until today it's been an error to do what they did in this trial. Let's kill him anyway. Let's just change the rule. That decision itself was an incentive for everything that I've done since, because I couldn't imagine that people actually felt that way, and that it was clear to me that this is something that was to be fought as hard as it could be along the way. So at this point, I'm not representing anybody at the moment, but I've tried to make myself available to anybody else who wanted me to do something that would be of help. And that's what I've done, something that's terribly important to me. I can't wait for the day when capital punishment, state killing in the United States is abolished. And at the moment, I'm finding all of these circumstances, the ALI decision being just one of them, that shows that the gallows has been eaten by termites. So it's only a question now of how long it will take before it falls in.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, I remember when I was flying to Europe when I was a little kid in 1956, I think, and I got off the plane in London, and there was a headline of the paper that said that England, or at least one of the chambers of its parliament, had abolished the death penalty. So that's only, how many years ago, Heidi? It's 44 plus 9, 53 years ago.
Plus 10.
So they're a little ahead of us. I'm glad to hear you're optimistic. Now, one thing that was interesting in your bio, David, was, because it reminds me of a book, was your, I guess, how old were you when Carol Chessman was given the death penalty? And maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that. And then I don't know if you read Bill Kunstler's well-known book about that.
I remember the day only too well. It had been on the radio that this was happening, and in my family, my parents were anguished about this. And I remember the afternoon that it was supposed to happen, I was in a music lesson, totally distracted by Sane, and thought, oh, you know, something's going to happen to save this guy. They're not really going to kill him. And then, lo and behold, they did.
Who was he? Why don't you tell us that, and where was he?
Carol Chessman. It's hard for me to even talk about the case, because basically, Carol Chessman was somebody who they put in the gas chamber at San Quentin, and they killed him. There had been a huge mobilization, a huge outcry from across the world of people saying that he shouldn't be executed. And I think that there was some optimism that maybe his sentence would be commuted.
You also mentioned, I think, in your email to us, that the other case that had a huge effect on you was the Rosenberg executions. How old were you then, and can you just give us a sense of that?
I was tiny then. The Rosenberg execution was, I remember specifically that my parents were totally freaked out at the entire thing. It was, you know, it was the kind of the McCarthyism's result. And all of the people who were, at that point, like my parents, basically Jewish leftists, were worried that the case was totally fabricated and that, in fact, there would be more of it. And it was the kind of thing that had all kinds of hushed discussions in my household with people that my parents knew from decades before about what did it mean. And it was an enormous topic and a tremendously important one, but at the time, not privy to the content of the discussion, just the emotional aspects of it and the way that it was just this incredibly painful thing for my parents and others who felt that this was the logical outcome of the discrimination against the left and against Jewish leftists particularly. Unbelievable. But those are the things in which when years later I see people trying to do the same thing, it's like obviously creates a resonance that it needs to have something done about it. And I had the tools, fortunately, thank God, that I could do something to oppose it.
David, in terms of the recent ALI decision, what do you think the effect will be on the individual states?
It's something that cuts out the intellectual underpinning of the thing. So now the battle seems to me to be entirely a political one, a political and a legal one. It's like there's nobody saying, you see, we've done the best we can with this, and this is really good stuff, and it's intellectually sound, and it works, and it'll preserve the system. You got nobody now saying that. You got nobody who's supporting it on an intellectual basis. So now it's just a question of people recognizing that there is no support for it. There is no deterrence. There's no way to do it safely. There's no way to do it correctly. That the format for the entire thing was just dead wrong. You would hope that it would fall in on its own weight from that.
We always like to let our listeners know what, if anything, they can do to be part of this movement of abolition. Can you recommend maybe one or two websites to go
including
to?
Including yours, David.
Well, my website isn't going to be as helpful as things like the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. There's a bunch of other websites that are like that. ACLU has done some great work in the area, but the main thing, what I find is helpful, is to go to the, if you Google death penalty, you'll see immediately what the main players are, and all of them, to one degree or another, have been badly hit by the economic climate and don't have any money to do stuff that they need to do.
David, do you have any last thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think that what you're seeing here is that you're seeing the collapse of a system that is completely unworkable. It's unjust, and that it's been a tremendous risk to all of us from executing people who are innocent. We don't know how many people there have been who have been innocent, who've been executed. This system can't die soon enough, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that we're at the point now where you're going to see it slowly fall apart, but you're also going to see the reaction to its falling apart by people insisting over and over again that it is deterrent, that it does work, that it is important. So I think that we're coming into the final stage of the end of state killing in America. It can't happen soon enough for me.
David Michaels, it's an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you very much and wish you all the best in your continued fight against the death penalty. Thank you, David Michaels.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs
and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Delighted to have back with us attorney Jim Lafferty for the second half of our Lawyers You'll Like series. Jim is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles and host of the Lawyers Guild Show, a weekly public affairs program on Pacifica Radio sister station KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Jim Lafferty has led and has been a spokesperson for various national anti-war coalitions, including National Peace Action Coalition, the Anti-Vietnam War Coalition, the National Coalition for Peace in the Middle East, and the National Campaign to End U.S. Intervention in the Philippines. In New York City in the late 80s and early 90s, he traveled the world organizing on behalf of the labor rights of merchant seafarers. During this time, he also taught a course at the New School for Social Research titled Vietnam, the War at Home and Abroad. More recently, he was the coordinator of the L.A. Coalition to Stop the Execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Jim Lafferty, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, you can't imagine how thrilled I am to be here. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
Does the audience already know we have this connection? Because 45 years ago, I didn't do it as well, of course, but I had your job.
You're the head of our L.A. chapter.
That's true. I've finally found my level of competence.
Well, Jim, we're really happy to have you all the way from Los Angeles. You are truly a lawyer we like. We wanted to talk about your career in and out of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And let's start from the beginning. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Detroit, you know, poor kid in the 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. like Michael Ratner and me,
uh-huh.
unlike Heidi. But nonetheless, you're coming up. What got you into law and politics?
Well, you know, they say all politics is personal at some level, and I suppose it is. I mean, without going into, you know, boring detail about it, I suppose my own the situation involving my own parenting, sort of the mysteries around that and everything, I think led to, on one hand, a sort of a healthy distrust, and on the other hand, a real kind of keen sense of justice, because to the extent that I felt unjustly treated by life in any way, then I didn't keep that to myself. The injustice to others immediately bothered me, I think, perhaps more than it would had it not been for that parenting mystery.
Well, and your suspicion about received truth,
like, yes.
In fact, who was Uncle Charlie?
That's right. Exactly right. Yeah, the man that I thought was my uncle and was presented to me as my uncle. When I was 16, he died, and my mother finally acknowledged that was, in fact, my father, which, of course, was shocking. Spent a little time on the couch talking about that over the years. But I think that that kind of being lied to, sense of injustice, that sense of the truth, as you just put it so well, Michael, not being what it appeared to be. If you're a halfway thinking person at all, you project that onto the broader society, I think.
Well, you went to the University of Michigan undergrad, and then you went to law school in Detroit.
Yeah.
What was the first kind of legal political experience you had that got you on the line that you've been on now yeah. for the last five decades?
It was an interesting and ultimately sad case involving a friend of mine who was a white nurse, and she had been married to a white school teacher. They had a three-year-old daughter. She divorced that man and married a black surgeon. The husband, the father of the child, and my friend's mother went to court to take away custody of this little girl. feeling that it was inappropriate and wrong for her to be raised in a biracial home. George Crockett was a lawyer in one of the founding law firms of the National Lawyers Guild. I was working for George as a law clerk. Well, actually, I wasn't. I take that back. I brought the case to George because I'd heard about him, and he said, I'll take the case if you become my law clerk and research and read every domestic relations opinion ever given down by the Michigan Supreme Court, which I did. So for a short while, I was the expert on that. And no other case, and no other situation where a woman, a mother was as qualified as this woman was she ever denied custody in the state of Michigan.
They took away her kid because she was living with a black surgeon.
That's right. And all the way up to the state Supreme Court, we lost that case. And then I continued working for that firm. And they made a movie about that, in fact, called One Potato, Two Potato, is the movie that they eventually made about that.
I remember the movie.
Yeah. In any event, that led to working that firm, becoming familiar with this George Crockett, Ernie Goodman law firm, Ernie Goodman, again, being a founding member of the Guild. These were radicals. They had been
the first
integrated law firm in the country. They'd been thrown out. They had been lawyers for the UAW. When the Red Scares came along, they were thrown out of the UAW for being, quote unquote, communists. That was the firm that developed workman's comp law in this country. The first really workman's comp firm in the country was that firm.
And they developed tort law.
And they developed tort law, yeah. And some of their partners became head of what was then called ATLA, the American Trial Lawyers Association. But all the while doing political edge, hard edge cases as well, which of course is what brought us to the South in the 60s.
And what about the Lawyers Guild?
And the Lawyers Guild, yeah. Well, that was it. When I got out of law school then, there was a big debate going on in the Lawyers Guild. Should we answer the call from the lawyers in the South, or should we just continue doing what we were doing, which was good work? And at a convention, it was decided that by the majority that, no, we should go into the South and answer the call of the Len Holtz and the two or three lawyers that were down there that, in fact, were trying to handle these hundreds of cases. As a result of that, and because the movement to do that came pretty much from the Detroit lawyers, it was decided the national office would move for the first time from New York to Detroit. And I was hired at that time for what is now Heidi's job as the executive director.
Was this a time when Arthur Kanoy went with Bill Kunstler down to the South?
Yeah. Sure, sure. That would lead to Bill's book, you know, So Deep in My Heart and all of that, that early experience of Bill Kunstler with Kanoy and others.
I can bring that full circle because 2 weeks ago we interviewed Jeff Haas about
wonderful
the assassination of Fred Hampton. And you know what book was on Fred Hampton's bed when the police murdered him?
No.
Kunstler's book, Deep in My Heart, which is dedicated to the Lawyers Guild lawyers, including you, Jim, who went down south in 63 on the voter education project.
That's right.
But anyway, you're down south now in 63, working with the Lawyers Guild. I know you met this marvelous woman, Mary Robinson. Tell us about that.
Mary Robinson was I was down there taking depositions on behalf of the Freedom Democratic Party. Remember, they were trying to get seated at that convention. And, of course, nobody was allowed to vote if you were black in the South, and they couldn't even register and what have you. And the first person that I was to interview for her deposition in a couple of days was a woman named Mary Robinson. Mary Robinson was a woman when I met her in her late 70s. She lived in a one-room, no-indoor toilet place outside of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. When I began interviewing her, I learned the following, that on her 70th birthday, she had wandered into town to get some groceries. She saw, as she put it, a bunch of young white folks and black folks marching in front of the local courthouse. She couldn't figure out what that was about. She went and asked them what it was about. They said, well, we're marching for voters' rights so people of color can vote. And she said, well, I said to myself, Mr. Lafferty, I'd been trying for years to register and never had. So then and there, I joined my first demonstration. And I was promptly arrested, she said. And I was thrown into jail. And while I was in jail, they stole my only warm coat. And when I got home to my house that we're sitting in right now, she said, I found my dog Daisy dead on the front lawn and a cross still smoldering. And she said, so ever since then, she said, whenever these young white folks come down to Mississippi, I figure they need a smiling face. So I always greet them, at which point she brought out some pie and ice cream. And I said, well, what possessed you, do you think, to do that and to get arrested like that? I mean, at your age, and you hadn't, you know. She said, Mr. Lafferty, she said, that's easy. She said, that was the first day of my life I ever felt free. Echoing that theme, you know, right back to Thoreau and others, this notion that when you finally take a stand, even if it leads to your incarceration and apparent lack of freedom, you are finally free.
In addition to your legal work during these years, there was the component of taking it to the streets, and I assume you were involved in the various demonstrations and political movements going on.
Well, that's when I met him, Heidi, because I moved to Detroit in 67, and Jim was running for Congress against the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And tell us about your involvement.
Well, sure. That was 67, when we formed, a number of us had met through legal services, then we formed a law firm in the same spirit of the People's Law Office in Chicago and some of these other wonderful law collectives. And Mike, you were certainly part of that, and that's where I learned a lot of my left education, because in that firm there were a couple of good socialists, and I was still just this kind of bumbling liberal. And so I learned a great deal about more disciplined politics. But I began to get interested right then. The law, I always felt torn between practicing law and actually getting out in the streets and doing what my clients were doing. I seemed to think they were having more fun than I was, I guess. In 67, there were a number of kids, 67, 68, a number of folks around the country, where Bob Scheer out here and back out in California, what happened, ran as peace candidates, just not expecting to win, just to bring up the question of the war. I did that. I ran against the most popular woman congressman in the country at the time. There weren't that many for that matter, but she was very popular, Martha Griffiths, and she was from the 17th district where I lived in Michigan. Campaign was great fun. We ran the entire campaign in the primary for $3,300. That included 10 small billboards at that time. Mainly, we just hit the streets and would dog her around. Ended up more or less getting the endorsement of the Detroit Free Press, who said they thought I was the better candidate, but because she had more seniority, perhaps that should tilt the batter at her face. The Detroit News simply referred to me as a communist in Democratic clothing. So we didn't win. We did get 17% of the vote, which I confess I always thought had more to do with the fact I was a man and she was a woman than anything else. But we took it as a small victory. Then there was a new coalition forming. And some of the young students from the university came to me because the Lawyers Guild had great respect. And came to me as the national director of the Lawyers Guild and say, hey, why don't you help us put together a coalition against this war in Vietnam? And I'll be honest with you, I knew almost nothing about the war in Vietnam at that point and thought it couldn't be done and thought these were just young folks with pie-in-the-sky ideas. Why I decided to do it, I don't know, but I did. And we did put together the Detroit Coalition to End the War in Vietnam Now. From that, I went on to become a national member and board member of New MOBE. And then when New MOBE got a little too conservative, it split, and we formed the National Peace Action Coalition, remember? And that was the organization that ended up staging the largest demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. That went on until the end of the war. During that time, the draft movement, our office, as you remember, Michael, was representing hundreds of men trying to stay out of the draft. Being in Detroit, we were on the border with Canada. You had a number of people going to Canada. We were of assistance to them in that. I wasn't simply representing people anymore, but as the head of this coalition, you were doing public speaking, you were organizing protests in the streets, and getting an appreciation for what the power of people could do. Even then, I began to realize the limitations of the courts. And in the 60s, the courts were much more amenable to what we were trying to do than they are today. That's when Arthur Conoy and Kunstler and people like that were able to make great strides in the South with removals under the removal statutes. You could get into federal courts in the North that still had, that weren't just stacked with Reagan and Bush appointees, you know. And so victories were possible in the courts, but still, and to the credit of those lawyers who were winning those victories, even then they were saying to younger lawyers like me, but the real important thing is what goes out in the streets. That's a proud history of the Guild, that it recognized that and didn't let its own ego around the law blind it to the fact that they were secondary to a mass movement.
With this visible role of activist and anti-war leader, it seems to me this was around the time that the FBI began spying on the National Lawyers Guild.
Yes.
And how did that, if at all, impact you? Were you the target surveillance? Or?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, Michael, he knows some of my file contents. These files always have silly and funny stuff in them. My daughter, for example, at the time was riding a tricycle, and we had bumper stickers on it. And the FBI commented that he's even warped the mind of his young daughter and turned her into a soldier from the anti-war movement or something, you know. The other thing I loved about my Detroit police file was that, you know, standard files, you know, in the Detroit Police Department for bank robbers, they'd always have modus operandi. There was a box, modus operandi, second story man, you know. Well, in my modus operandi box, it said lawyer. And I thought that was fair enough.
Right.
Well, you know,
our office was actually a house
yeah.
that
oh,
we bought. Right. Yeah. And Jim was pretty good at carpentry, so he fixed it up. And we had offices on the first, second, and third floor. Mm-hmm. We had a little building in a neighborhood behind the General Motors headquarters. And every week or so, it was uncanny. The burglar alarm that we put in the first floor was a sonic burglar alarm. It sent out sonic waves. And if anybody got into that first floor, the burglar alarm would go off. And it kept going off. Yeah. And I couldn't figure it out. So, you know, I said, maybe we have a mouse in there, or maybe a moth or something. and we could never figure it out. And we didn't figure it out. Here's how naive we were. We didn't figure out that the secret police were breaking into our office and looking through our files on the draft resistors and on the GIs that were resisting the war and speaking out against it. They were looking at our files and probably photographing our files. And we only found that out years later when Dick Sobel brought a lawsuit for us.
That's right.
And we got the Michigan State Police records and found out that they were regularly breaking in and setting off the alarm.
Yeah. And there's a great quote on the back of a book of yours, Michael, that early book you wrote, Lawyers You Like, or 60s Notebook of a 60s Lawyer. I can't remember which. Where it said, we're always very proud of that, of course. It says, the Police Department of Detroit says, there is not a, and then it lists, a black nationalist, a civil rights activist, a women's right activist, an anti-war activist, blah, 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 that the law firm of Lafferty, Riasty, Smith has not represented, you know.
And so that's fabulous.
We all said, yes.
Yes.
Well, let's fast forward a lot up into the time you left Detroit and you were in New York doing work for indigent sailors, merchant mariners, and then your companion, Bonnie Garvin, she's a screenwriter, and she thought there's more opportunities out in Los Angeles. So about 18, 19 years ago, you moved out to Los Angeles, where you are now the executive director of the Los Angeles chapter.
Exactly.
Very successful chapter of the Guild. Let's talk about what you're doing out there, because I think that there's some interesting things that we can learn from your work out there.
Well, there's two things I feel really good about. One is that our chapter, I don't know, I can't speak for all the other chapters. I know many of them doing similar work. But because L.A. and Southern California in general is one place where the labor movement, I should say, the labor movement is vital. I mean, the labor movement in this country, it's no secret, is in bad shape. But it is very vibrant in Southern California and especially in and around L.A. Given my own interest in that and our chapter's interest in that, we spend a lot of our time defending workers in and around, whether it's day laborers, whether it's the people that work for sweeping up and cleaning up the hospitals, you know, whether it's the car wash workers now, whether it's the 10,000 people who have the Lancheros truck, the little catering trucks, you know, independent small working groups. Went into our chapter, along with some other folks, was the first effort ever to organize within Koreatown. The unions have always been afraid to organize in Koreatown in L.A. because they considered it impossible. We took that on with a group of independent workers' advocates and have had great victories there, really. Getting back to the roots of the Lawyers Guild, right, Heidi? Because we sort of started off as a national bar association that spent a lot of its energies on behalf of the working class and behalf of the trade union movements. We're doing that in L.A. today again. The other thing is the anti-war movement has become very vibrant in L.A. It wasn't always so. When we have demonstrations now, they're generally about the same size as the demonstrations in San Francisco. While I don't want to give our chapter undue credit for that, we've certainly played a role in it. We've been very active with the Answer Anti-War Coalition and with all the anti-war coalitions we reach out to and help in and around Los Angeles. Because again, I mean, if there's one thing that ought to be clear, and I get very frustrated because it doesn't seem to be clear, if there's one thing that ought to be clear to anyone who wants to end the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq is that, well, I mean, this last election sort of put the nail in the coffin of those who thought you could elect your way out of a war. The war in Vietnam ended what? Under Nixon and Ford, hardly meant a peace. It ended when it did only because of the victories on the battlefield by the Vietnamese and because a massive anti-war movement in this country ultimately, after 10 years of struggle or so, made it impossible for any Congress or any president, be they Democrat or Republican, to continue the war. That's a lesson that we learned then and seem to have forgotten now. You've still got many wonderful, well-meaning people in the anti-war movement who think, oh, if we can just get Obama elected to office, he's going to end. He says he's for peace. He's going to end the war. My God, we now have a war that continues in Iraq, a new war in Pakistan, thank you, Mr. Obama, and a wider war in Afghanistan. that has disoriented, his election has frankly disoriented the anti-war movement again, just as the elections of, or the effort to get a McCarthy elected back during Vietnam, or the notion that Johnson was going to save us from the war, whereas Goldwater wouldn't have. That same mentality, after all of these years of experience, I don't mean to sound bitter about it, but it's frustrating to me that that rather clear lesson has not been learned by everyone who wants peace in this country.
I want to add that, in fact, your chapter and your individual work as a leader in Los Angeles mm-hmm. has had huge repercussions throughout the city. I visited Jim a little over a year ago to see a friend of mine who runs a homeless shelter on Skid Row. And Jim and I went down and she gave us a tour. We ran into several activists or community leaders. When I introduce them to Jim, they're like, oh, Jim Lafferty, we know you, your work through the National Lawyers Guild, your radio show. Mm-hmm. And I had this vision of a sprawled LA where there isn't the kind of organized activist community that, you know, we might have in different parts of the country. Yeah. And au contraire, there's a very vital community. And our friend Jim is at the heart of it, along with some other guild members, yeah. Carol Sobel, well, and sure, yeah. people doing excellent litigation yeah. on behalf of the May Day Melee and
oh, yeah.
the police department there. Your yeah. work is critical.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not suggesting that you don't want to go into the courts these days, and I wonder what Michael's reaction is now Michael Ratner has joined us. But I do think, Michael, I was making the point earlier that whatever could be done in the courts in the earlier days of the struggle of people like yourself or people around the Lawyers Guild, that court system is not as welcoming today even as it was then, in my judgment, and at least. And therefore, the notion that we need to be in the streets, the notion that that our role as a lawyer is as much as anything to keep our clients able to function as political animals in the streets or wherever they're functioning as political animals, is as important, if not more important today than it might have been in the 60s when perhaps it was possible to make more progress in the courts. I don't know. I base this on part of what our friend Ann Ginger always argues, watching some of the court decisions that I see coming around the country today. I wonder, what do you think? Can you accomplish as much in the courts today, do you think, as you might have in the earlier days of the civil rights
movement? Yeah, but with the guild, with the center.
Yeah.
I mean, all those groups were always looked to the streets before they looked to the courts.
No, I made that point as right. well. No, I didn't mean to suggest that they didn't. I'm just saying now it would seem like it's even harder in the courts to do that.
Well, I mean, so that's, I think that history is really crucial because
yes.
when you look at today, I think
yeah.
you still want to get your lawyers out on the streets.
That's
I mean,
right.
I think, and
you
that's what keep, you've done so well, what Heidi's done
yeah,
so well.
You want to keep
I mean,
those think, clients out there. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's absolutely crucial. And if I look at what's happening at my office now at the yeah. center, you know, obviously as we got into Guantanamo, a lot of that battle happened in the courts.
That's right.
And the courts on some issues
yes.
are still
oh,
maybe
yes.
one of the only places you can do certain things. But it shouldn't become the exclusive part of any radical organization.
No, I
mean, if I look
that.
At certain issues, it's from abortion to the Guantanamo issues, certain other kinds of issues that you'll never get this right-wing Congress to do
that's
a
right.
thing.
That's right.
So
that's right.
In some cases, you're relegated, but I still think the major role for a radical organization or a radical person is to represent social movements that are trying to make change and do it in the streets.
Yeah, that was
I mean,
my
that's,
only
that's
point.
That's the key.
Absolutely.
I agree with that.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's
Jim, let me ask you,
yep.
based on your experience during Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
When you argued that people shouldn't get suckered into this or that Democratic peace candidate,
mm-hmm.
but the movement should stay in the streets,
mm-hmm.
and then the movement seemed to have collapsed around Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was really kind of demobilized
mm-hmm.
In the last several years. Do you think that there's a chance now of getting things back on track after Obama's speech escalating the war in Afghanistan?
Oh, I really do. I'm not pessimistic as I look ahead. It just seems to be what I was suggesting earlier was that it kind of saddens me to realize the lesson has to be relearned. And each time it's relearned, we waste some time. More lives are lost in Afghanistan or Iraq, and more American lives are lost. But I think that if just look at Obama's approval ratings in the last month or so, what the dip that they've taken, as the failure in Afghanistan becomes more apparent, as the impossibility and the wrongness of that, as we finally begin to get the message out that once again it's oil, in this case a pipeline, that is bringing us there, not because we give a damn about anybody who's in Afghanistan and the geopolitical importance of Afghanistan. As that all becomes clear, as the American casualties grow, I think the anti-war movement will. Next March 20th, for example, we'll test that out. We're going to have national demonstrations by all the anti-war groups in the major cities next March 20th. another anniversary. I think that we will see a growth from what we've seen, for example, in the last year. I don't doubt that because eventually, first of all, you have new generation. We have no education in the schools. You can't really blame the young anti-war activists for not understanding their own history because nobody has bothered to teach them about it much. Radio shows like this try to. You certainly don't get in this in the public schools. I'm often amazed at how many of the young lawyers that we have in the Lawyers Guild that are wonderful and have a good gut and intuitively want to do the right things know so precious little about the history that and the shoulders that they're standing on. And as they learn it, they're better lawyers. They have a better sense of what Michael was talking about, of how their first job is not to be necessarily a hero in the courtroom or to think they're going to make a revolution in the courts, but to enable their clients to hopefully make some kind of revolutionary or at least serious reform via political action.
What's your overall appreciation of what we on the left need to do, not just with respect to reconstituting the anti-war movement, but where would you like to see the movement go?
Well, of course, I'd like to see the movement coalesce around a meaningful left socialist third party. Short of that, you're not going to solve global warming or climate change. The notion that somehow corporate America is going to be able to reform itself, capitalist America is going to be reform itself to the extent where it can really get a handle on climate change is silly. The notion that imperialist wars will somehow be put to an end because we have a somewhat more liberal Democrat than we had a somewhat more conservative Republican office is silly. And economic justice just on a domestic front, you can't achieve that way, it seems to me. You know, I sometimes argue that, it's imagine there are two boats out on a lake, and one of them is the Republican Party boat and one's the Democratic Party boat, and they both have holes in them. And I'll even grant there's more holes in the Republican Party boat, but stay in either one of them and you drown. That's a hard lesson to get across. People, when you say that to people, they say, oh, it just can't be done. We've tried that before. We've got to do the best we can with what we've got, Jim. But that just prolongs a slow kind of slide into oblivion, an oblivion of more climate change, an oblivion of more injustice. We're now the most economically stratified country in the industrialized world, a greater separation of wealth and poverty, and on it goes.
What do you say to people who argue, stop trashing Obama, he's doing the best he can, he is constrained, and you're going to get yourself a Republican elected next mm-hmm. time?
Yeah, what I say to them is, On the issue of the war, we're worse off now than we were under Bush. We have a new war in Pakistan and a wider war in Afghanistan and no real end in sight in Iraq for all of his talk. When you read the fine print of what he's talking about, he's not talking about getting out of those places. We have immigration policy that is as punitive as it was under Bush, if not more so, and no talk of any reform coming about. You've got a health care plan that I think is regressive ultimately. Its passage, I don't think, will represent progress at all, but I think we'll put in place a more regressive system.
Frankly. Why do you say that about the health care plan?
Well, because all it is a boondoggle to the insurance companies. If you insure those who weren't insured before, the profits of the insurance companies aren't going to go down. You and I will simply pay more, whereas the government should be doing that. Read this morning's New York Times, where they've already agreed to put aside the question of a public option for now. And that's how they get past that hurdle. You see, you get past the hurdle by not dealing with real reform. And the climate stuff. So maybe Obama wants to have a 50% cap at a certain point on greenhouse gases, whereas Bush only wanted to have a 20%. But if you need an 80%, then all you've done is prolong that death. All you've done is mean your boat's going to sink a little later. So if you aren't finally willing to bite the bullet and say, the hell with it, whoever it is, neither of these can do anything better than give us a slower death. That's the only option here. I'd rather jump out of one of those boats and take my chances at getting to the other shore rather than just say the hell with it.
Jim, your chapter has done a remarkable job of bringing new law school graduates into the guild. And we should remember, this is a guild. We do mm-hmm. try to mentor and mm-hmm. train new ranks of activist attorneys. And you do educate them about the history mm-hmm. of the guild and political movements. And I also know of instances where guild lawyers have brought young people into their work. And I know you do that.
Oh, yes. Well, it's our future. I mean, we always say in the guild that the law students are our future, but then we don't always act that way. Send them off to file a pleading or something and call it a day. Our board, at the end of our monthly board meetings, we have something in the guild, as Heidi knows, called the Next Generation Committee of the younger members. When I say, okay, our board meeting is now adjourned except for the Next Generation Committee, that means of the 25 or 30 people sitting in the room, about 7 of us get up and leave, And the rest are the Next Generation Committee. Our presidents are both under 40 years of age. You know, one of them's only been out of law school about 3 years. They're not always right. Neither were we. But at least they're doing something. They've got more energy than I've got, that's for sure. And so they come to say, what about that? I said, I don't know, try it. Give it a whirl. See what happens. Well, but you can't beat something with nothing. It's exciting to see it, especially as you do get older. And I'm now 71 years of age. You get older, you realize you're not going to be doing this forever. I'd hate to look around that table and just see a bunch of old farts like me. You know, I'm thrilled when I see these young folks.
Jim, you're not only a radio show guest, you're also a weekly host in L.A.
More than that, it was Jim's program that inspired us to try it out in New York. And thanks to WBAI and particularly to Bernard White, we're sitting here today. But it was because of Jim's program.
We have a weekly show called The Lawyers Guild Show in California. It's been on in one form or another for about 25 years. I've been doing
it's
it.
It's a very popular show, right?
It is a popular
25
show.
25 years?
Yeah, I've only been doing it for 18, but it's been in what?
Who
it
did
used
it
to be called
you?
Phil Brimble and Leon Golden did it for a number of years before me.
It's a drive time show, and it has a huge audience.
And we have great fun with it. We do the same kinds of things you do here. I often get ideas when I'm talking to Michael or to Heidi about a guest we want to have and vice versa. And we do. We are on the web, of course, kpfk.org, www.kpfk.org. We
stream live
every Thursday night, Pacific Coast time, from 7 to 8 p.m.
Well, Jim, it's a pleasure to have you in New York once in a while.
It is indeed.
And we look forward to talking to you again about updates in the world of civil liberties.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Heidi. Thanks for all your great work.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.